like a child and let the cloudy draw.
This is Michael Koski. I'm a volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm pleased to bring you Western stories. The first story today is called Gentleman Jim, and it was written by J.W. Throgmorton, and I'll give you a little bit of bio on him right after the story. The clerk swept around the four lazy Bar H cowboys draped over the wooden crates in the shade of the Prescott Stage Depot. Although they hadn't broken any furniture or started any fights, the cowhand's Saturday night had been a humdinger. Bent on drinking every drop of beer in the Palace Saloon, they'd gambled and danced with the ladies until well past midnight, but the morning had exacted an atonement for their night's revelry. Their heads throbbed with each heartbeat. Mouths of cotton and nauseous stomachs rendered them unable to endure the jarring ride back to the ranch. To make matters worse, they had not a nickel between them to buy the proverbial hair of the dog. Thundering hooves and the rattling of harness chains wrapped in a cloud of dust announced the arrival of the southbound 10 o'clock stage. With a heavy head, John Tucker glanced up at the big clock that hung on the crumbling adobe wall. Next year's completion of the railroad to Prescott would put the stage line out of business, so no one saw fit to make building repairs. 9:40. She's early, Tuck said. She's late, Frank Johnson corrected. Leaves at 10. The driver's hollering and the stomping of nervous horses made enough noise to cause the cowhands to decide on retreating to a quieter location to recover. They stopped dead in their tracks when they saw him step down from the faded red coach and began to knock the dust off of his attire. Perched on his head was a shiny black hat shaped like an upside-down bowl with a brim too small to provide shade. The man's suit jacket and tapered leg pants resembled a blue and green plaid horse blanket. White linen spats that barely reached his ankles covered his shiny black leather shoes. The bow tie he sported around his neck looked like a woman's fluffy scarf, and he wore gloves that buttoned at his wrist and matched his spats. The man's duds held them mesmerized. Frank was the first to speak. "Would you look at that?" The comment was rhetorical, since they all stared. "Danged if that don't beat all. It's a dude," Tuck said as he, along with Pete Johnson, Frank's brother, and Jack Kelly, began to laugh. The man paused to survey his surroundings and then stepped onto the boardwalk to await the offloading of his luggage. As he waited, he became aware of the four men sprawled on the crates in the shade of the mesquite canopy attached to the tired old building. The man turned and strolled to where they sat. Jabbing his elbow into Tuck's ribs, Frank said, "Oh, now you done it. We don't need trouble." Tuck lowered his voice. "He's a dude, and a purty one at that." He commenced chuckling again, but Pete and Jack refrained. Approaching, the man tapped the brim of his hat. "Excuse me, gentlemen, may I inquire as to the location of your town's hotel?" Confused, Tuck stared up at the man. It was as if he spoke a foreign language, which to them he had. "Huh?" Tuck asked. "Hotel. Could you direct me to your town's hotel?" Pete pointed. "It's that-a-way," he said. "The palace. It's across from the courthouse yonder." Jack rose on his shaky legs and inhaled deeply to quell the sick feeling in his stomach. After the queasiness passed, he said, "For the cost of a beer, we'll tote your goods to the hotel." "Why, thank you, my good man. That would be a splendid arrangement." Tuck eyed the man suspiciously. "Does that mean yes?" The man grinned, showing all his teeth. "It most certainly does. I mean, yes." Frank and Pete took hold of the travel trunk and lifted. Pete grunted with the strain and then muttered, "Should have made it two beers." Jack carried the dude's carpet bag, leaving Tuck to carry the man's black leather pouch with gold embossed initials, JJC. His spurs jingling from the long strides, Tuck worked to keep in step with the tall dude. "What brung you to Prescott?" The man smiled at Tuck's inquisitive nature. I'm a thespian, and I am joining my theatrical company here to offer your community a sample of our repertory. Tuck could only stare. He didn't understand a single word the man said. If you don't want to say, I guess it'd be your business. You jackass, Jack said. He's a play actor, and he's meeting other ones here to give us a show or something.
Oh, is that true, mister?
Tuck asked. It most certainly... yes. Danged if that don't beat all, Tuck said. Heard about him, but never seed one. Well, you shall see one next Saturday night. Please, gentlemen, come as my guests, he boomed in his deep bass stage voice. Then he swirled his hand in the air with a flourish like a ringmaster from a circus. Tuck, Jack, and the dude stood outside the Palace Hotel and Saloon, waiting for Frank and Pete. Cowhands earned their living from horseback, occasionally on the ground mending fences, roping, and branding, but they never wandered far from their horses. The high-heeled boots kept their feet in the stirrup, but they were poorly suited for walking, especially carrying a heavy and awkward trunk. "Guests for what?" Pete asked. "You gentlemen shall be my guest next Saturday night here at the Palace Hotel to see my troupe's performance of Shakespeare's Hamlet." Tuck had pulled off his hat and was scratching his head. "You in the army? I mean, what's troopers got to do with play-actin'? I know they paradin' round and such, but..." Jack, who had attended school and could read and write better than the others, tried to explain. "It's T-R-O-U-P-E, not T-R-O-O-P. He's talking about the other play actors." "Then why don't he say so?" Tuck demanded. Jack just shook his head and looked apologetic to the dude as they entered the hotel's lobby and restaurant to drop off the luggage. The dude retained his good humor. "It's quite all right," he said. "I still wish for you to all be my guests. Now, for the libations I promised for my part of our agreement." No thanks, Tuck said. I'd rather have a beer. Jack, embarrassed by his friend's continued display of ignorance, turned to Tuck and asked, "Where was you raised?"
"Well, my folks come out here from Kentucky when I was but a young'un, and I run off when I was about 14. You know that. Why's you asking?"
"It's by way of explanation to the gent," Jack said. Tuck looked at Jack and then to the dude with a confused expression on his face, and finally he just shrugged. "Let's get that beer," he said, and pushed through the swinging doors that separated the saloon from the hotel. Jake, the burly bartender, looked up from the glasses he'd been drying when they entered. "I told you boys last night, no credit." The dude, who had come through the doorway last, said, "It's quite all right, sir. I'm paying for their drinks. Would you be kind enough to pour four beers for us all?" Jake paused. The dude tossed a silver dollar on the bar. The bartender's nimble fingers snatched it up from the bar's smooth varnish top quicker than a card sharp dealing from the bottom of the deck. He promptly placed four reasonably clean glasses filled to the brim on the bar. "Ah, that's a good man. Thank you." The lazy bar-age cowhands, badly dehydrated, tilted their heads back in unison. When they sat their drinks back down, the mugs were nearly empty. "Oh, that hit the spot," Tuck said, and he looked at the dude. With an understanding twinkle in his eye, the dude smiled. Despite his dress and manner, he was not a stranger to a hangover, and he knew their need. "May I buy you gentlemen another beer?" "Oh, sure thing," said Tuck. "Oh, you bet," Frank and Pete chimed in. "Thank you," Jack said, and they all pushed their mugs toward Jake for refills. "Easy on the foam," Tuck instructed. The dude's silver dollar brought them four rounds each, which brought heavenly relief to their throbbing heads, nauseous stomachs, and trembling hands. In fact, they were near ready to start another night of celebration. While they stood at the bar sipping their beers, they naturally started a friendly conversation with their host. Tuck, ever the nosy one, asked, "So how long you been a play actor?" "I've been in the theater for several years now. I'm from San Francisco originally, and that's where I started as an actor."
"So your folks was actors?"
"Oh, no, certainly not." He straightened and his tone changed slightly. "My father did not approve of my becoming a thespian. His preference was that I continue with my budding career as a banker. However,
I chose the theater in its stead.
Well, then, what did they do for a living?
Tuck was persistent, if nothing else. Jack spoke up.
Tuck, you're being terrible nosy. Let the gent be. He treated us to these beers.
Oh, it's quite all right. I enjoy the conversation. One likes to tell about themselves, if there is an audience. Your Mr. Tuck is my audience du jour.
Ha! That's one I know, du jour, Tuck beamed proudly. They have that at the Frenchy restaurant. It's a soup they're offering for the day, right?
The dude smiled. That is close enough, my friend. Across the barroom, seated alone, nursing a bottle of rotgut, skulked Steer Johansson. No one rightly knew Steer's real given name, but Steer suited him. He tipped the scales at over 300 pounds and towered over everyone in town at his height of nearly 6'4". Steer was a cruel bully and an uncommonly mean man when he was drunk. A while back, it took the sheriff and two of his deputies to haul him off to jail after he assaulted Widow Barton for no reason other than when she didn't get out of his way quick enough. Too large to sit a cowpony, Steer worked as a ranch hand. Though no one here claimed to have witnessed the event, it's told that after a horse stumbled and fell under his weight, that he killed it with a single blow of his fist to its forehead. Since Steer was vicious, people accepted that rumor as fact. The Mule Shoe ranch owner had just fired Steer after he threatened to break the cook's neck. Steer thought the gravy was too watery. The cook presented the owner with an ultimatum. Either Steer had to go, or he would. The owner wasn't sure if the cook was angry about the threat or the watery gravy comment, but no matter, it genuinely hadn't required any contemplation on the owner's part. Truthfully, he had wanted to fire the lazy oaf anyway. He ate big and worked little, and the men generally didn't care for him. The outcome of the situation had left Steer in a black mood and searching for someone on whom to direct his anger. He had been watching the dude with the Bar H boys, and 2 days of drinking cheap whiskey had only increased his surliness. Steer decided the dude in his fancy clothes fit that bill. Steer stood and staggered his way to the bar. Frank and Pete lounged against the bar on the dude's right. "Out of my way!" And with an exaggerated swipe of his huge arm, he sent the Johnson brothers to the floor. He had seen the big man's approach and recognized the behavior of someone bent on trouble. When Steer turned on the dude, he wasn't there. The dude had stepped away from the bar, and although he hadn't raised his fists, he was ready for Steer. Tuck stepped in front of Steer. "You got more than 100 pounds on him. Sides, he's a dude, and he don't know how to fight." "I sincerely appreciate your concern, Mr. Tuck, but this drunken bully doesn't appear very threatening." Tuck and Steer both turned to stare at the dude. "Huh?" they said in unison. Jack translated. "He says for you, Tuck, to get out of his way so he can deal with Steer." The Johnson brothers had eased up off the floor, but kept several feet between them and Steer. Tuck hadn't moved, and Jack smiled at the prospect of some entertainment before they returned to the ranch. It would give them something to talk about. Steer leaned back against the bar for stability and sneered down at the dude. "You know who I am, Mr. Fancy Pants."
"Oh, my apologies, but I do not. Are you a local celebrity?"
Tuck moved next to Jack and asked, "What's a sea labor tea?" Jack seemed to have accepted that he would have to act as an interpreter for Tuck, and most likely Steer as well. "It means a well-known person, you know, like the mayor or sheriff." Steer puffed up. "They call me Steer on account of I'm so big. Everyone round here knows me, and they know to stay shy of me when I'm on the prod." Mirth shone in the dude's eyes. "Steer, you say? Ox would have been more appropriate, don't you think? In either case, Mr. Steer, I can certainly see why the good people of this community would prefer not to abide your companionship." Steer's eyes squinted. He'd understood the words well enough, but he wasn't sure they meant what he thought.
"You making fun of me?"
"Oh, certainly not. In a way that you would understand." Jack chuckled. Steer glared first at Jack and then the dude. Even in his drunken stupor, he knew he'd been insulted. Why else would Jack have laughed at him? Steer growled, "Nuff talk, Fancy Pants," and then he lunged. The dude sidestepped the giant's rush, stuck out a foot, tripping him, and placed a well-aimed punch to the base of his skull as he went down. Steers splayed across a table, which collapsed from his weight. He didn't stir. Chuck scratched his head. Never at a loss for words, he spoke first. "Danged if that don't beat all. Old Steer went down like a bag of feed." Jack and the Johnson brothers looked on with amazement. "Mister, you just poked a stick in a big old nest of hornets," Jack said. "You best be out of town for it and he sobers up, and that's no joke." "I would not be so concerned, gentlemen. I have dealt with large bullies before, and it may be that he has learned his lesson." "Gent, you just don't seem to understand your predicament," Tuck said. "You know how he got the name of Steer? He killed a horse once with his bare fist." A wrinkled brow conveyed the dude's confusion at Tuck's sentence. Jack translated, "Tuck means that he's big as a steer, and it's told that he killed a horse with a blow from his fist," Jack added, "but no one's seen it firsthand." "I see," said the dude. "Be that as it may, I have a contractual obligation to this establishment. Departing town is not a viable option." "But," Tuck started to speak. The dude raised his hand to halt further discussion. To Jake, he said, "Please have the cost of replacing the table added to my hotel bill," and he left the saloon. When the boys returned to the Lazy Bar H, they spent the entire week repeating the story of how the dude had bested Steer Johansson. By the end of the week, the cowhands believed that Steer had been beaten to a bloody pulp. The next Saturday, only a few hands stayed at the ranch. The rest went to town to see the dude that had whipped Steer. Saturday morning in Prescott, Arizona, was the business day of the week for the neighboring ranchers and their hands. Except for the 4th of July and rodeos, the town held their social activities in the coolness of the evenings. During midday, when it was the hottest, people tended to stay indoors, or at least in the shade. The Palace Bar was packed for a Saturday morning's business. Beer was the beverage of choice, and it poured freely. The Lazy Bar H hands had taken over the Palace and were waiting to see the dude. Steer Johansson also waited in the Palace, but this morning he wasn't drinking. Quiet conversations and darting glances from the cowhands left Steer without doubt that they were talking about him, but no one laughed. Best not if they knew what was good for him, he thought. He had laid low all week to avoid the stares and comments from the townfolk, but come Saturday, the cowhands would return, and he would have an audience when he whipped the dude. When the dude appeared in the Palace's restaurant for a late breakfast, the Lazy Bar H hands crowded around the doorway, each of them pushing and shoving to secure a better view. Finally, Steer got up from his chair and marched to the doorway. Sensing his approach, the men pulled back, unblocking his access to the restaurant. He ground to a halt when he reached the dude's table. He stood with his thumbs hooked over his belt and waited for the dude to look up. The man continued eating, ignoring Steer and likewise the crowd that had formed behind him. No one had ever dared ignore Steer before, so he was not accustomed to it, and his anger quickly grew to fury. Red face and teeth bared, Steer grabbed the edge of the dude's table and hurled it across the dining room, crashing it to splinters against the wall. The dude looked up with an amused expression. "Your action was solely at your initiation, and therefore the cost of the repairs shall be at your expense." Steer's brow furrowed with confusion. Jack Kelly, who had been watching, called out, "He means you gotta pay for the damage, Steer." "Outside, Fancy Pants, it's time for you to start learning that Steer Johansson ain't so easy a fight when you're facing him and he's sober." "Are you so grandiose that you must speak of yourself in the third person?" "Huh? Eh, it doesn't matter. I'm sure you are not. Outside," I said. "We'll see who's the best man round here." Tuck pushed through the men. He had something to say. "Steer, this gent can't weigh more than 190, and you got longer arms. This ain't even close to a fair fight." Rumblings from the other men confirmed their agreement. "Mr. Tuck, once again, I am indebted to you for your attempt to trying to safeguard my person, but I assure you that your effort is unneeded." The dude strolled out onto the boardwalk and looked up and down the street. Steer followed with the cowhands on his heels. May I suggest we settle this matter at the local livery? There is no need to disrupt the rest of your community. However, Prescott was a small town, and word traveled fast about Steer and the Dude, and most of its occupants had already gathered outside the Palace Hotel.
Yeah, it's okay, Steer agreed. Your funeral, so wherever you want.
And he marched off towards the stables. The Dude and the crowd followed at a more leisurely pace. Steer climbed first into the empty corral, followed by the Dude. The Dude removed his jacket, bow tie, and shirt. He vaulted the fence and landed nimbly on his feet, facing Steer. For a fleeting second, Steer seemed to reconsider his decision, but when the onlookers began to root for the Dude, his fury returned, and he wanted to fight. Crouched like an animal, Steer began stalking his adversary. He tried to maneuver the Dude into a corner of the corral where he could manhandle him with ease, but the Dude ducked and dodged to stay in the center of the pen. Soon, Steer became winded from the exertion of trying to land a punch on the quick-footed Fancy Pants. The Dude, however, had no problem whatsoever in striking the huge man at will. Cheers rang out from the crowd every time he landed a punch on Steer. Steer's rage appeared all-consuming. The Hulk made a desperate lunge for the Dude, catching his pant leg as he fell. At first, he seemed confused by his good luck, but his expression changed as he obviously relished his capture. Covered by blood-caked dirt, Steer slowly dragged the dandy hand over hand towards him. He moistened his lips with anticipation, but was too soon disappointed as the Dude raised the heel of his free leg and smashed it onto Steer's nose. Blood flowed as if squirted from a pump. At last, the Dude broke free and leapt to his feet. Steer also rose, but much slower now and more leery of his opponent. The Dude moved in, and with a flurry of body punches, Steer dropped his guard completely, exposing his chin. With cold, calculating accuracy, the gent landed a single uppercut squarely on the hairy dimple in Steer's chin. Steer felt his knees go weak and a wave of darkness washing over him. Then he collapsed in the dirt. The townspeople applauded and cheered. The crowd passed a fire bucket full of water, which the Dude dumped on Steer's head. He sputtered and shook his head to clear his breathing and eyesight, which swollen tissue markedly limited. "Have you had enough, or do you wish to continue?" the Dude asked. Steer raised a hand. You win!" Again, the townspeople cheered. "If you do not mind some advice, I suggest you move along to another town, and there try to be a bit more sociable." Steer could only nod. A couple of ranch hands who had worked with Steer helped him up and back to the saloon for a medicinal whiskey or four. That night, nearly everyone in town surrounded the saloon's small stage. They were there to see the play and the man who had whipped Steer Johansson. Jake, the saloon's bartender, acted as the troupe's announcer. He stepped out onto the stage with the prepared script in hand. "Ladies and gentlemen," he announced in a loud, pompous voice, and the audience laughed. "I am pleased to introduce tonight's cast. As Hamlet..." Jake halted. He stared dumbfounded by the words written on the paper. "What is it?" one of the spectators yelled. "Out with it!" called another. Finally, Jake cleared his throat and began again. "Hamlet will be portrayed by James J. Corbett, the current heavyweight bare-knuckle champion." Jack said, "Glory be, that's the gent that whooped John L. Sullivan." Tuck remembered seeing the JJC embossed in gold on the Dude's leather pouch, and all he could think to say was, "Danged if that don't beat all." And that brings us to the end of Gentleman Jim, who I'm sure those of us who remember history remember a real character known as Gentleman Jim Corbett. Now, J.W. Throgmorton is originally from Indiana and now lives in Sarasota, Florida, with his wife. He worked as an architectural engineer, construction executive, and business owner, and has taken him and his family from New York to California, from Wisconsin to Florida, and multiple locations in between, giving him a wide exposure to people and places from which to draw the inspiration for his characters and settings. In 2008, J.W. was able to leave the corporate world to pursue his lifelong dream of becoming a writer. In addition to Duncan at Green River, J.W. has written other books and short stories, and at this time, J.W. has started on another book and hopes to be writing for many more years to come, for which I can only say I'm glad because I thoroughly enjoyed that story, and I hope you did too. Well, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Koski, and I'm your host this afternoon for Western Stories. Thank you so much for tuning in. Our next story is a little bit different from the traditional Western stories we have read, and it's called Look There, and it was written by Diana Wagman. Vernon Whitman stood on top of the big rock and took off his battered Stetson, the better to feel the breeze in his hair. He spread his arms. The cottonwood trees were in their full green glory, bright early morning sun glittering in the leaves. Wildflowers burst like yellow fireworks across the plain. In the distance, the monoliths of red stone stood guard, marking the boundary of his territory. It was the second week in June, and the country was as beautiful as it ever would be, and he was master of all he could see. He was alone, beholden to no one, equipped with enough food and gear to make his life on the trail easy. He clambered down into the cool, moist canyon where he kept his bedroll, the rock walls still holding on to their winter chill. The only thing he was missing was his horse. Dottie was a pinto, brown and white, with a star-shaped blaze between her shiny eyes. She'd been stolen from him, and he aimed to get her back, and soon. There was an empty, loose feeling where she belonged, as if his boots had no place to go without her stirrups. He had just sat down to drink another cup of coffee and contemplate his best course of action, when a ways away he heard the muffled sounds of men. His well-trained ears heard the voices getting closer, whispering to each other in a language he did not understand. Vernon snuck up over the walls of his adopted cave and lay flat on the rock, prone but steady. A small band of three young Indians came into view. Their soft-soled shoes made no noise in the dust, but they kept talking, and one of them, a tall fellow with a shaved head and beads hanging from his ears, laughed high and loud. The others hushed him nervously. They were all grinning, and Vernon knew they were up to no good. A hunting party would not be so noisy unless they were hunting something more sinister than breakfast. He could have let them go on about their business, but Vernon had a bad feeling. There were many things that he could let pass him by. He might be master of this particular universe, but he was not interested in the couple he came across down in the hollow pretending the spring weeds were their marital bed, or the more than one man and even a woman who chose to relieve themselves behind a tree or a rock, or the woman who came and let her pet cats go into the woods and then turned and ran from them. The abandoned kitties were not his problem. The human waste did not bother him, although he was careful to dig a hole and cover his own droppings. The couple was mostly amusing until the girl's shrill finishing left him with an awkward feeling in his gut. These Indians were different. He knew he had to follow them. The leader had a knife, and Vernon suspected the others were armed with knives tucked into their buckskin pants under their woven shirts. The sun was rising quickly, and where the trees gave way, the yellow light pooled on the path as if spilling from the sky. Way up ahead, he saw a figure moving quickly in his direction. A girl. She was running towards him, passing from shade to light again and again. Her light brown hair had come loose out of her bun and streamed behind her. She had a little smile on her flushed, pretty face. He saw she was moving for the joy of it, not away from anything or toward anything else, but just because it felt good to run. The Indians had seen her, too. They got quiet. They slipped into the shadows and hid. Vernon hurried forward past them beyond the bend in the trail so that would dump her right into their ambush. He waited, then reached out and grabbed her as she went past, one hand over her mouth to keep her from screaming, his other hand taking hold of both of her small wrists as she flailed. He pulled her behind a rock. "Shh," he whispered, "I'm not going to hurt you." Her eyes were wide and frightened, and a rich, dark brown like Dottie's. He smiled at her and nodded. "I mean it," he said. "I'm protecting you. Look." He showed her through the trees where the Indians had come forward on the path, puzzled that she was not there. The leader threw his knife in a tree out of anger or frustration. Vernon felt the girl's sharp gasp beneath his palm. He could fight these Indians and win, but he was all for avoiding a fight if he could. Wasn't cowardice, just good common sense. Where there were three Indians, there were probably more, and killing these would just bring down the wrath of the rest. The leader collected his knife, and all of them trotted back down the path in the direction they had come. Looking for another victim, Vernon supposed, but heck, wasn't his job to keep the whole countryside safe. He let go of the girl. "Did you have to grab me?" She leaped to her feet and away from him. "You scared me to death." "Better than what those Indians had in mind." "Indians?" She looked him up and down with her hands on her hips. Vernon felt his own cheeks redden. He was embarrassed to be caught in the clothes he had slept in. His chambray shirt and worn jeans were not the cleanest. This girl made him aware it had been a while since he'd had a bath. He straightened his hat on his head and nodded. "Looked like Cherokee to me. Did you see that one with the shaved head?" "Right." I didn't recognize their particular dialect, but... "Oh, you mean Spanish?" Hadn't sounded like Spanish to him. This girl didn't know the first thing about Indians. She was mad at him for saving her, and now she's frowning at him. "So where was a girl like you running to?" he asked her, "so early of a morning. What were you thinking? What's wrong with exercising?" "Nothing, I reckon, if you're prepared for the consequences." She shrugged. She was pretty, damn near the prettiest girl he'd seen in a long time, but he couldn't tell if her mind was mixed up or if she was just a pure, innocent soul. He took his hat off and circled it in his hands, and then he looked at her again. He could at least say, "Thank you." "Thank you," she said. "You're right. I'm sorry. Thank you." "You're welcome." She looked past him down the path. He saw her itching, ready to get going. Vernon hadn't spoken to a person, much less a woman, in a long, long time. So long he couldn't remember back that far. "Cup of coffee?" he asked. "I got my fire going." She was startled at his request. He knew he'd been bold, but he didn't want her to go, at least not yet. "Oh, I can't," she said. "Your folks expecting you?" "Well, I have a job. I have to get to work."
Okay then."
The disappointment came in like a cloud in front of his eyes, and then he thought, well, if she had a job, meant she wasn't married. "What do you..." He started to ask her what she did, but she interrupted him. "How do you live?" she asked. "Do you have any money?" "I don't think that's any of your business." Just like a woman, to want him working in a bank, holed up in some building somewhere. Most of them only cared if a man had a good job and a regular paycheck. He was sorry to think she was like that, too. She reached down into her small white shoe and pulled out a bill. $5, it looked like. She handed it to him. Her hand was little, and the skin looked rough and dry. Wherever she worked, she used those hands. Maybe she did laundry for people. She bit her nails, too. He could see that. It was his turn to step away from her. "No, no, thank you kindly. I got some pesos stashed away." He did not take money from women.
"Well, can I bring you some food later? A sandwich?"
"You inviting me for supper?"
"Well, I thought I'd bring you lunch."
"Well," he said, "that'd be right nice."
"Well, good."
She turned to go. Her hair was messy but shiny against her pale neck, strands of blonde and red and brown all mixed together. She wore some kind of tight leg coverings and not much else. "You shouldn't go around these woods half-dressed," he said. She laughed, and her teeth were white and straight and just the right size in her little mouth. "How'll I find you?"
"How about we meet up right here? I got some chores to do this morning."
1 o'clock? He nodded. "You want me to walk you home?"
"Oh, I'm fine. There are plenty of people out now."
He hadn't noticed before, but at her mention he was aware they were practically surrounded. Two men were trotting toward them. A woman looked him up and down as she walked past, pushing her baby in a carriage. There were a couple of young people drinking coffee, sitting on a rock down a ways. The sage had gotten positively full of folks. He hunched his shoulders as he turned away. Times were changing. He needed to go further, deeper into the brush, the rocks, the canyons, far away.
"Oh, bye," she called.
but he was too occupied to do more than raise his hand. The noise was louder. He'd been hearing it more often lately, a rushing sound, a whoosh, a roar, almost like thunder, but lower and constant. The vibration in his ears woke him up at night. It was just over there, just out of sight. But when he came over the hill expecting a waterfall or at least a river flowing by, there was just more of the same dust and leaves and rocks and trees. Where was this grumbling coming from? It was like a train that never stopped. Vernon knew from experience that things were not always what they appeared to be. That had been the story of his life. The father, who acted happy and said nice things to him in public but shook his head when they were alone, who always told him what he saw was wrong, always wrong. His father, who acted happy to return, but who did not love him, did not even like him, hated him, in fact, and had arranged for rustlers to steal Dottie. He knew it. He had recognized one of the outlaws, a big man dressed in white and black. He'd seen his father speaking to him at the house one day, right before Vernon left. For a time, Vernon had been with some other horseless cowboys. They'd camped together, traveled the range together, but they were not truthful men. He caught one of them taking money from his saddlebag. They said they'd help him get Dottie back, but when he outlined his plan, they refused to cooperate. He took off on his own after that, and he did not miss them. He had gone north and west the day before, searching for the man in black and white who had taken Dottie. Today, he was aiming to cover south and west. It was slow going, but he was being thorough. He assumed she was hidden in a herd somewhere, or locked in a barn out of sight. He hoped she hadn't been sold off to a tribe of Indians or some rancher heading out to the Wyoming territory. He drank the dregs of his coffee and put out his fire. He hid his bedroll and supplies back under the rocks. He arranged things so it wouldn't look like he was camping there at all. He knew his father was looking for him, but he also knew he was good at staying hid. He headed out towards town, towards his father's house, but he had to go this way. He had no choice. Anyway, it was hard to stay worried on such a fine day when he had met such a pretty young woman. He grinned all alone in the sunlight, and he laughed. He would pick some of those wildflowers for her and get back to camp early to tidy up. His path led him along the edge of the cottonwood trees. He saw more evidence of man here, refuse and forgotten items of clothing, plenty of footprints. He walked slower now, more carefully, trying to be as silent as one of them Indians. Town was just beyond that row of bushes. He knew Dottie was nearby. He could feel the warmth of her hide on the inside of his legs, hear the creak of the saddle just like he was riding her. His hands curled around the reins in his mind. "There!" a man shouted. "There he is!" The man in black and white and two others came crashing through the trees. Being as they were inferior horsemen, they were on foot, and Vernon turned and ran. If he could get above them, he could kill them all. His hand went to his holster. Where was his pistol? What had happened to it? Those bastards must have stolen it with Dottie, confused in his mind, so he thought he still had it. He could outrun him. He knew the sage better than anyone. The man in black and white was tending towards fat. Already Vernon could hear him breathing hard, huffing and puffing, in and out, in and out. "Whitman, stop!" the man struggled to cry out. Vernon laughed as he climbed the hill above him. "You come and get me!" He kept climbing and laughing. This was easy. He would leave him in the dust. "You can't live out here all alone." That was his father's voice. Vernon stopped. He looked back. His father was silhouetted against the sun, Monument Valley towering behind him. Vernon's gut twisted. The rushing sound, the roar, got louder. Instead of simply sending his henchmen, his dad had come to find him. "Return my horse to me," Vernon hollered. "That's all I ask. If you'll come over here, I will." Vernon hesitated. The men and his father had stopped, too, the man in black and white leaning against a tree, getting his breath. They were waiting for him down at the bottom of the hill. "Where's my horse?" he called. "Come down. Come down and see." He knew that old ruse. He looked out the other way. The sage went on and on. His home, his kingdom. Right here, right at his feet, there were flowers as yellow as the sunshine. He reached down and picked a handful for her, for the girl. He would just go back to camp. He would look for Dottie tomorrow. He started away, forgetting his father was there, forgetting the man in black and white. He was thinking about the girl and her smile, and wondering if he could make her laugh. If he went back now, he might have time to clean up some in the pond. There was always someone at the pond that would stare at him as he washed his face and hair, and sometimes his feet, but he couldn't help that. He wanted to look nice for her. He was hungry, and he hoped she would bring something good for lunch. The hardtack and dried meat he ate every day was getting tiring. Wait! He stumbled once at the top of the hill, and then he squared his hat and kept going. Wit! His father's nickname for him. For Christ's sake, look around! Vernon turned. His father. He might probably never see him again. Look, his father said. Out there, what is that? His father pointed out above the trees. The red rocks wavered. For a moment, they became gray and menacing. And that! Something giant lumbered past, rolling through the trees. And those! A caravan of wagons and coaches. Where were all the horses? His father was a powerful man. The sunshine went flat, the sky got heavy, the clouds seemed like they were falling all around him. Perhaps it wasn't spring yet. Maybe winter would stay on a while. He shivered. His jacket was back at camp. I didn't do nothing to you, Vernon called down to his dad. I know you don't like me, so just let me be. Give me back my horse and let me be. He had dropped his guard. It was his own damn fault when the man in black and white jumped him from behind. Vernon hadn't wanted it to come to this, but he punched the old man hard and felt his nose crack. The others were on him then, and they were fighting hard for their friend. The grass was wet. The slick soles of his boots could not find purchase. As the men brought him down, sat on his arms and legs, and kept him flat on his back, he opened his eyes and saw a bird above him. It crossed the sky, high, high, high. It sparkled for one moment, almost silver. It was so beautiful, his eyes teared up. Vernon watched it until it went out of sight, and he nodded farewell. His father came up then and knelt beside him. The West is over, Daddy, Vernon said. We've been run off. They dragged him down the hill and out of the sage into town. The man in black and white was bloody. He gave Vernon a sharp elbow to his ear as he loaded him into the back of a waiting police car. Oh, don't hurt him, came his father's voice. Oh, no, sir. One yellow flower was still clutched in his hand. Vernon let it drop onto the dirty floor mat. Whatever did he have that for? And that was Look There by Diana Wagman. Now, Diana Wagman has three novels published and short stories in L.A. Noir, Black Clock, and Electric Literature. She also writes occasionally for the Los Angeles Times. And I hope you like that sad little story. And this last story is called A Change of Heart by Paul Peppers. There were only a few people in the bank, which was a good thing, Frank decided. He hated the thought of innocent bystanders being hurt or killed. He had learned from experience that Russell didn't care. Russell was a mean son of a bitch and would just as soon shoot a man as look at him. Whenever Russell pulled his gun, inevitably someone died. Not for the first time, Frank wished he'd never hooked up with the men he now rode with. The move from farm boy to criminal had happened so fast that he was on the outlaw trail before he'd even realized it. An old lady was talking to one of the bank tellers through a barred window. She was a gray-haired old woman, and though her dress was old and worn, it was also neat and clean. She reminded Frank of his own mama. With the thought, he felt a pang of homesickness. She noticed him looking her way and smiled. "Good afternoon, young man," she said in a tremulous voice, looking at him over the top of her spectacles. "Afternoon, ma'am," he said, tipping his hat. He looked away quickly and walked slowly by. He felt the old woman's gaze on his back, and suddenly self-conscious, he wondered what she thought of him. He rubbed a hand across his chin, feeling the stiff blonde whiskers. He was overdue for a shave. His clothes were dirty, his boots were worn down at the heel, and he'd not bathed in a week. Surely she thought he was a bum, and that's if she was feeling charitable. What else could she think? Maybe she felt sorry for him. Had he detected a note of sadness in her look? Distracted, he rested one hand on the pistol holstered at his side. The gun was clean and well kept, the only thing of value that Frank owned. He glanced at the old woman again. Frank harbored no illusions about himself. He was a thief, but not yet a murderer. At one time he had looked up to Russell and the other outlaws, but he had soon learned the truth of their big talk. Russell had killed his first man at 15, a drunk he'd murdered outside of a saloon in Dallas. Russell had laughed when he described how the man's brains had splattered. He noticed that Russell was also watching him and with a questioning eye. He knew that he was worrying about the other man. He was supposed to stay close to the guard, but the old lady had distracted him. "What the hell is wrong with me?" he asked himself. Maybe it had been a mistake for him to volunteer to work the inside on this job. "Young man, oh, young man!" Frank turned to find himself face to face with the white-haired old lady. She was holding a couple of ones and a few coins in her fragile porcelain white hands. She smiled and held out a wilted greenback towards him. Oh, no, ma'am," Frank said, stunned by the gesture. I can't take your money." He realized that his words were meaningless. After all, they were planning on taking all of the money. His face reddened with shame. "Don't you worry," she said, "and don't be embarrassed either. There ain't no shame in being needy. Now here, you..." Frank glanced over the old lady's head just as Russell unholstered his revolver. "Russell!" Frank yelled urgently. "Russell!" His yell jarred through all the other sounds in the room. Holding the pistol ready, Russell darted looks around nervously. Frank stepped past the old lady, placing his body between her and the other man. "We're leaving, Russell," he heard himself say. "You lost your damn mind, boy?" Russell hissed. "We come to do a job, and we ain't leaving here till we get it done." "We are leaving now," Frank yelled angrily. He couldn't do it, just couldn't let it happen. He couldn't let the damn animals start shooting. Oh, not now. Frank did the only thing he could think of, pulled his gun. He would have to shoot Russell. The other man must have read Frank's intention on his face, and before he could bring the weapon level, the other man fired. The 44 round hammered into his shoulder, almost knocking him off his feet, and time slowed to a crawl. Finally, slowly, he had the gun up and pointed at Russell, and the weapon bucked in his hand as he fired. A hot stab of pain shot through him as another bullet struck, but he managed to fire the gun again. Frank found himself sitting on the floor. He thought it strange because he didn't remember sitting down. Across from him, Russell lay sprawled lifeless on the bank floor, blood streaming from a ragged hole where his ear had once been. Frank tried to rise, but his body would no longer respond to his wishes. He wanted to holster his gun, but it stubbornly remained resting in his limp hand. His mama leaned over him with tears in her eyes. For some reason, she held a dollar bill in her hand, and it reminded him of a Bible passage she had once read to him. "And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. And he called his disciples to him, and said to them, Truly, I say to you, that this poor widow has cast more in than all they who have cast into the treasury for all they did cast in of their abundance. But she, of her want, did cast in all that she had, even all her living." And that was A Change of Heart by Paul Peppers. Now, Paul is a diesel mechanic who lives in Cartersville, Georgia. He has an Associate of Applied Science degree from Coosa Valley Technical College, and he's 53 years old. And you are listening to Western Stories here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And as we do at this part of the show, I like to switch from cowboy stories to cowboy poetry. My last couple of installments, I have been reading the collected poetry of a gentleman named Rudy Gonzalez, and I have more of his this afternoon, and I hope you enjoy him as much as I do. This first one is entitled, "What Does a Real Cowboy Look Like?" Some think a cowboy is supposed to be tall and lean, good-looking, of course, with tight-fitting jeans, a thin, wiry frame with legs slightly bowed, and with his pants tucked inside for his boots to be showed. He rides a fancy pony if he rides for the cattle, and atop his steed sets a mighty fancy saddle. His head is a Stetson that's creased to his style. He's got a big silver buckle you can see for a mile. Oh, he struts like a peacock with a bit of swagger. Talking about roping and riding, he's a bit of a bragger. Why, he could rope the wind if given half a chance, and steal any lady's heart with one handsome glance. Now, I've known some good cowboys who were tall and lean, but most I have known were not cut out to be mean. Most know the work and are caring endowed. This leaves little time to strut around proud. But Purdy, of course, don't make a buckaroo, and it don't help a bit if your horse lost a shoe. And that buckle he bought can't doctor a cow. And working stock, well, you gotta know how. I know a passel of cowboys, and most ain't even cute, but I sure want them with me when I'm loading the chute. When working the stock, they don't need to brag. They're always first to join in when riding the drag. Some are short and stout, and some downright fat, but when it comes to the job, that's right where they're at. Truth is, most cowboys don't fit a physical description. To think they're all tall and good-looking is just plain downright fiction. Now, I'm a cowboy who's not real tall or even good-looking, and most of this round comes from my wife's down-home cooking. I'm no different from most, and I know who I am. I'm that cowboy from Idaho who looks like Yosemite Sam. And this next one, by Rudy Gonzalez, is called A Bronx Lesson. I guess I've heard as many bronc tales as any fella my age. Stories and poems of wild horses, a tearing up of the sage. Oh, they buck, they snort, they jump so high, they hit the ground hard. I'm here to tell you one and all, I've been there myself, old pard. Now, tales like this have but two ways to go, so I'll turn the choices loose. One gets throwed and hurt his pride, while the other rides that old cayuse. But my tale is different, don't you see? I taught a moral lesson to that steed, and when you find out just what I did, I'll be sure that you would have agreed. Now, I've been riding that there colt for just a month or so. This day I had a lot of fence to mend and quite a ways to go. Well, the morning was a cool one, and he was feeling kind of light. But with the long day of riding fence line, I really didn't expect a fight. I dismount and mounted throughout the whole day long. I twisted, cut, and stapled, and I even sang a happy cowboy song. As we rode back towards my camp, a rabbit jumped from beneath his feet. He spun and he whirled and gave a jump, and they bogged his head to make this fight complete. I lost the offside stirrup, and with my next jump I hit that rocky ground. It took me several minutes before I could sit up and recognize that sound. No, it weren't the choir of angels singing or birds singing away the day. It was the sound of horseshoes hitting stone as that colt there ran away. Now, what is the moral that that colt learned when he run and left me there? Did he fall and break his leg, or was he eaten by a wandering grizzly bear? I thought and chuckled to myself on that long walk back. I even kicked a stone. I sure fixed that ornery hoss, 'cause I made him walk back to camp all alone. And the last one I'd like to read you by Rudy is called Circle Flies. Hauling a big load of my best horses from a ranch on to the sale, wanting to get there early, I was traveling along like a bat out of, well. Oh, sure, I knew I was speeding. I like to sit there close by the rail. Sometimes you wait to get unloaded, and I wanted to watch my horses sell. Glancing back in my mirror, there were lights a-flashing blue and red. That police siren crying like an old coyote. I knew that I was dead. This trooper took out his ticket book and right away began to write. He took my license and registration. He was going to ticket me upright. I tried to tell him about my situation, hoping he might understand. Sometimes a fella means no harm when he's hurrying across the land. This trooper had no giving him, said he was the long arm of the law. He said he'd make an example of me as he boldly jutted out his jaw. I told him I was just a poor old cowboy trying hard to make ends meet, needing to sell them horses I only wanted to get there to claim my seat. He said this here ticket would take $500 to make my bail, and if I hear another word from you, I think I'll just haul you off to jail. I noticed his hand a-waving some pesky flies from his head. I said I thought them circle flies would now all be dead. He said he never heard of circle flies. I told him they're common on the ranch. They buzz around and pester the horses' butts whenever they get the chance. He raised his head and loudly said, "For sure this ticket I won't pass. Now I'm gonna throw the book at you for calling me a horse's ass." "Oh, no, officer, not me. I have too much respect for the law. It would certain be my demise. It's just not my way to call you names, but I guess you just can't fool them circle flies." And with that, we close out this week's edition of Western Stories. My name is Michael Koski. As always, it has been my pleasure to be with you. So until next time, when we can be together, be safe, be well, and let's be kind. You've been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
Walk the Line.
He was hit by a truck, and you were lying out in that gutter dying, and you had time to sing one song. One song that would let God know what you felt about your time here on Earth. One song that would sum you up. That's the kind of song that truly saves people.
To ask you how you came up with that sound. It sounded like a train, sharp like a razor.
We'd play faster if we could.
The taste of love is sweet.
We're all going to hell for the songs we sang.
And what about me, Charlie? Am I going to hell?
No, Jim, you're beautiful.
Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire.
Sorry, just happened.
You should try taking credit for something every once in a while.
Come on, baby.
Baby, 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 baby.
I fell into a burning ring of fire.
Tell me you don't love me.
I don't love you.
Liar.
When the flames went higher.
Mr. Cash, why don't you refrain from performing any tunes that remind the inmates that they're in prison?
Think they forgot?
The ring of fire.
Joaquin Phoenix, Reese Witherspoon.
And what's with the black?
It's like you're going to a funeral.
Maybe I am.
Walk the Line.
The audio described Walk the Line. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area.
It's 88 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus Updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello again, this is Christina Abernathy for the Georgia Radio Reading Service, continuing with The Devil in the Junior League by Linda Francis Lee. This is the eighth reading from the book, which was published in 2006 by St. Martin's Press. If you remember last time, Nikki needed only one more sponsor to help her join the Junior League. Howard was beginning to tire of the changes in wardrobe and behavior that Nikki expected of him. Freddie had a romantic encounter with her artist, and she found out her husband had divorced her. And now we continue. "What else did you sign?" Howard asked. "I hadn't a clue, but I was very afraid I was going